Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to MacGuffin Men. I am Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. Follow us on Twitter, at themacguffinmen. James, what are we talking about today?
Apocalypse Now.
We do not have time to just gallivant about in the jungle like Francis Ford Coppola did. So.
Oh, yeah. He would look like a great time, didn't it? I guess, yeah, we should mention that this is a it's somewhat kind of twofer here.
Yeah.
Apocalypse Now and Hearts of Darkness, filmmaker's Apocalypse.
Yeah, so we'll talk about Apocalypse Now first. I'm sure Hearts of Darkness will make its way in there.
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously pretty well interconnected.
Yeah.
Francis Ford Coppola directed this movie.
He did.
And it was based on a screenplay written by John Milius. Mm-hmm. Also very loosely based on the book Heart of Darkness.
Yeah, correct.
By Joseph Conrad. And I mean, I haven't read that book, but everything I know about it, it seems very loosely based in that, you know, that was set in Africa in the 19th century and had nothing to do with war, let alone the Vietnam War.
Yeah, it was about colonialism for the most part. I have actually read that book. I can't believe I have that. This is the one literature leg I have up on you, I suppose.
Yeah, no, it's, a very well-respected book. And as you said, it's, the trade-off, I guess, is that in the book, it's European colonialism, whereas in the movie we have American military interventionalism. Mm-hmm. Would be kind of the main themes being explored, but we also have kind of ideas of just madness and morality and the darkness of the human spirit. And
sorry, you went away there.
Oh, sorry, just tons of fun stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't know you read that book. Good for you. when did you see this movie first?
In high school, after I finished reading the book.
how do you like the movie?
I enjoy it. I've always have. This is one of those the types of movies that I'll always have more of an affinity for, in that filmmaking's really impressive and to a point that I am totally okay forgiving the problems that the script has, which are numerous. And it's a really wonderfully like visual story, and I really enjoy that about it. And I think that the whole thing is structured around a giant metaphorical journey. I enjoy a lot. It's like that scene from The Dark Knight Rises where Batman's crawling out of the cave. It's like that, but for 2.5 hours. And that's kind of my jam, you know? Like, I like that type of stuff.
Yeah, it's a very different movie, like, mm-hmm. right from the get-go. Very kind of unsettling. And I saw it described as a new Hollywood masterpiece. Mm-hmm. How does that description fit in with this?
Well, it's the new Hollywood, I mean, is sort of the way that we would describe a group of directors like George Lucas, Spielberg, Coppola's in there as well. Coppola's kind of the bridge between like the really great American Renaissance in filmmaking and then the blockbuster filmmaking. And the Apocalypse Now is kind of like this really good middle ground between those two things, because Apocalypse Now is this very, stylistically, it's a very European film. Francis Ford Coppola has always lean towards European influences a lot, and this is a really good example of that. Like, this is more indicative of Francis Ford Coppola's entire filmography than any of the Godfather movies are, and in that way it's sort of very Hollywood Renaissance sort of thing, the American new wave type of thing, whereas it's also a gigantic movie with all these helicopters flying around, and there's so much spectacle in portions of this movie. And even watching it, for the first time in a number of years, I was watching it again this past weekend, and I was blown away by the scale of some of these scenes, man. Like, there's so many helicopters flying around. And just in the background of a dialogue shot. Like, it's crazy. And so it's this really interesting combination of this really, like, auteurist thinking and then also this really explosion-y type of thinking, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, that one scene that's, you know, the most famous scene of the kind of the helicopter attack with the flight of the Valkyries. Mm-hmm. It's so impressive. And like visually, so many of the parts of this movie are stunning, even parts where, you know, as you say, they're not as explosion-y. You know, they're just shots of boats going down rivers that are just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah. But
yeah, when you see some of these big scenes, it's just the amount of work put into the filmmaking to get all this together, and yeah, all these helicopters, all these things on the ground, all the pyrotechnics, it's just amazing to look at in that scene. Even though I kind of knew it was coming and you've seen it spoofed so many times and you kind of know so much about it, I was still just taken aback by just the massive scope of that scene.
Yeah, exactly. And even things that even after the, I don't know, I suppose for lack of a better term, money shots, the scenes where Kilgore is like just throwing the dead cards on the corpses, and you'll just see a helicopter flying around in the background, or you see a shadow of a helicopter, so you know it's there. It's not even in the shot, since you know it's the 70s, like they're not CGIing in this thing, and it's unbelievable. Like, it's so, I don't know, it's so unique that way.
Yeah, and I guess to kind of tie it to Hearts of Darkness and the actual process of putting this movie together, it's such a huge movie. And I mean, you know, it shows up on screen, but there are so many things that didn't show up. I mean, they shot so much footage to make.
Yeah.
So built so many sets and then had them destroyed and rebuilt. And just the... I don't know, the documentary Hearts of Darkness is just fascinating, you know, from a kind of a filmmaking perspective, but of all the work that goes into any movie, but this movie in particular, just the absolute disaster of how much work was put into making this, like getting this movie off the ground. Mm-hmm. Like Orson Welles tried to make this movie in the an adaptation of Hearts of Darkness, yeah, and you know, wasn't able to do it, and you know, had to make
sorry, you cut out.
It had to make Citizen Kane, which is just like another massive, massive, like a massively important film in the history of cinema.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You like Hearts of Darkness too, then, right? The documentary?
Oh, yeah, quite a bit. It's, I mean, I love documentaries about filmmaking just in general. Particularly filmmaking gone awry. I suppose I've never seen a documentary about a film that just goes according to plan.
Yeah, that's not a good documentary.
I would find it fascinating, to
yeah,
be honest.
You would.
I think like one of the things I was thinking about Hearts of Darkness is any director that is, you know, generally considered very, very good should have some 90-minute documentary documenting the entire production of one of their movies. And it doesn't matter if it goes well or if it goes poorly. I think it would be fascinating and it's really interesting historical document to have, you know? I think that would be really cool to see how just, you know, see how Wes Anderson or P.T. Anderson or Nolan or somebody like that just works on a day-to-day basis. I think would be fascinating.
Oh,
beyond, you know, the people hired by the studio to do behind-the-scenes work, you know, for DVDs and stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of like promotional material.
Yeah, exactly. I think that would be really fascinating. Obviously, so few directors would be okay with that idea, but, you know.
Right, and one of the things I found so interesting about Hearts of Darkness that I didn't know until I watched it, and this was my first time watching it this week,
mm-hmm.
It's Francis Ford Coppola's wife, and it's something he thought she told her to do to like keep her busy. Well,
yeah.
You know, we'll go to the Philippines and we'll shoot for 6 weeks, and this will keep you out of my hair, and like just all the massive problems that he could never have encountered. And you know what just the crazy story she manages to capture while he's trying to tell this other bigger story.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like 230 hours worth of footage they shot for this movie, all the time editing, like 3 years to kind of get together after the starting of principal photography.
Well, yeah, and part of the reason they have so much footage, even aside from all of the delays and stuff they would have, is that Francis Ford Coppola just writes and writes, and a lot of the times there's not strict adherence to the script in his film. There was a documentary that came out around the time of The Godfather 3, where I think it was Al Pacino says, with Francis, the script is like newspaper, there's a new one every day. And you see a bit of that with him talking to Dennis Hopper towards the end of Hearts of Darkness. But that's what Francis Ford Coppola would do on set, and they ended up with so much is that if something was taken away by weather, you know, a set got destroyed, they were still going to shoot on their shoot days, you know? And so he was just going to find something they could shoot. And he went into the jungle not liking the ending of the script, and so they had to find that well there.
That's one of the craziest parts to me. Like, something like a typhoon or showing up not having read the script and being like 60 pounds overweight. Things are kind of hard to predict, but how late in the production he did not even know how he wanted to end this movie. That's insane to me.
I mean, that happens sometimes in movies and almost never goes well. Remember Devil's Own, that movie with Brad Pitt and Harrison Ford? That's not a very good movie. It was just sort of, there was, before the screenplay was finished, both of them had free time in their schedule at the same time. It's just like, we have to make this movie now. We'll figure out an ending. You know, we have Brad Pitt and Harrison Ford. We can't stop this. You know, we gotta make it happen.
What else are some of your favorite attacks or crazy things about the making of this movie?
Anytime your lead has a heart attack as a 36-year-old, it's fascinating. I love all crazy stories, so everything involving Brando I think is my favorite.
Right. I think Coppola just constantly threatens suicide is fantastic.
I don't know. I'm sticking with Brando. I enjoy me some Brando.
How do you like him in this movie, though?
I think he is quite good, but not irreplaceable. I think that's one of the things about this movie, performance-wise, that I find is that I think everybody's very good, and I was trying to think of who in this movie I would be, you know, upset if they were switched out as an actor, or who I couldn't see played by anybody else. Dennis Hopper was the only one that, like, but I was like, I can't imagine anybody else in 1979 playing the photojournalist, you know?
Yeah.
So Brando's fine, but he's not in peak condition, physically or skill-wise, you know?
Yeah, what they had to put up for someone who I don't think really makes the movie better, you know?
I like the cart scenes a lot, and there's something about his look in this movie that I like a lot, but I don't think it would have been impossible to attain with another actor.
Okay. I want to say the movie takes a serious turn when they start getting to, when they get to living in the temple, you know, musing over, like, poetry and the human condition. But the fact that that isn't, like, a standout difference from most of this movie.
Yeah.
Goes to show what a wild movie this is.
It is very bizarre.
Yeah, and I want to classify it as a horror movie, and you can make an argument for pretty much every horror movie being a horror movie because, you know, you're dealing with such dark themes and people are dying, but this, to me, is the number one candidate for a horror movie that's also a war movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that really draws me to this movie is the weirdness. Basically, any of the scenes where characters are like, there's a light blinking on and off, and everybody's just totally submerged in darkness for large portions of the scene. Everything at nighttime at Kurtz's compound, and whatever that bridge is that the last sort of location they get to before Kurtz's compound, all of those scenes are just so I don't know. That's the thing that really excites me about this movie. It's this sort of really weird, off-kilter way of capturing the story. And the whole thing is very kind of off-putting. And but also
kind of
well, yeah, definitely off-putting, like, but not in a way that makes you dislike the movie, you know. It somehow it draws you in more, you know, and that's the type of thing that I really love, that in film is this sort of feeling that you can't quite place your finger on, like, what's great about this, and but you just still find yourself more engrossed as the scene progresses, you know.
Yeah, I couldn't think of other movies that, like, just gave me that same kind of feeling. But yeah, that bridge scene that you brought up is just so discomforting. And, you know, he's tripping on acid. So I think, like, you know, they try to shoot it as though I think you're dealing with that trip. And there's a lot of, you know, weird lighting and audio things that are happening. Yeah. But it's just terrible. And they're boating through the water, and all the Americans are, like, jumping in the water trying to get on their boat and go home. It just sends shivers down my spine. Like, it's really, really discomforting, like, for large portions of this movie in a row.
I love it so much.
I know. And then you get kind of these beautiful shots of the Philippines, where it was shot, supposed to be Vietnam, but like, just a gorgeous part of the world. And that you get the purple smoke happening, like, you get these really bright colors and these beautiful landscapes, but then so much about it is just so awful and just creeps me out.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't ever want to do acid in the war. I don't want to go to war.
I don't know that I want to do acid or go to the war either, or, you know, like, yeah, I'll take a hard pass on both of those things.
Especially after this.
I still would have taken a hard pass before this.
What do you make of the scene early on of them shooting the war documentary as Willard's running by and telling them not to, telling him not to focus on the camera?
Yeah, just keep fighting, just keep fighting. Just yells it over and over again. I am indifferent to it. I don't think it makes anything worse. I don't think it makes anything better. It's just sort of another
what?
Another thing for them to come across and be indifferent to.
And weirded out by, like, all of us.
But what do you feel about them? Anything?
No, not really. It was kind of just a little meta moment of, you know, a film being made inside a film that I didn't know if you'd want to address or not.
Yeah, well, and Francis Ford Coppola likes to throw in a lot of references to filmmakers in general. This is, I mean, the most upfront in that the camera is trained on the filmmaker of this movie, and the cinematographer, who's the director of photography, is the camera person in that scene. And, you know, there's a character named Corman in this movie, I believe. Harrison Ford's character is named Lucas. Harrison Ford's character, named after George Lucas, friends with Francis Ford Coppola. At one point, very early on in this movie's, you know, in this movie's infancy, was going to be the director of Apocalypse Now. And Corman is meant to stand in for Roger Corman, who Francis Ford Coppola got his start directing for. And there's stuff like this in the Godfather movies as well. Francis Ford Coppola likes doing these winks that aren't really funny, but I think he finds them funny, but doesn't understand that they're not funny to other people, you know?
Yeah. The thing about Lucas directing it is, they talk about when they were thinking about doing this movie and shooting it in Vietnam while the Vietnam War was going on.
Yeah.
And been a more smooth operation than what actually happened. Like, I think just goes to show about what a clusterfuck the production of this movie was.
Yeah.
And again, as I said,
it might have been slightly more dangerous, but it still probably would have gone smoother.
Oh yeah, it would have been shorter. As I said, Orson Welles wanted to adapt Hearts of Darkness and went on to make Citizen Kane instead, which is, you know, sometimes argued as the best film ever made.
Yeah.
Then we have when Lucas was trying to get this going, he couldn't, he didn't really want to, went off and made Star Wars, which, you know, is massive. And then Francis Ford Coppola's attempts to make this and not really getting it off the ground for a while, he went and made Godfather 1 and 2. It's just, that's an amazing set of movies to be made instead of making this movie. And then this movie ended up being also, like, so well respected and such have such cultural significance. That's just amazing to me.
Yeah, for sure. I think the least of all of the movies that you've mentioned, but still, to be in a group with those movies and not be an afterthought of a movie is still pretty, just an impressive thing to accomplish, you know?
Yeah, that's crazy to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you like Martin Sheen in this?
I think he's quite good. He doesn't have a lot to do for a lot of it. I mean, that's sort of his role is to... There are very few times in this movie where he actively acts on something. Most of the time, he's just sort of there to be your eyes and ears for... Or the audience's eyes and ears for this journey. There's a lot of POV shots, like from Willard's point of view in this movie, in a way that I didn't remember. And after when I was watching this again, the first one that we get where he realizes he's still in Saigon, we see him open the blinds and look in the window. I was like, wow, that's weird for Francis Ford Coppola. And then it's like 100 more in the movie. And it's just because he's supposed to be our stand-in. So he can't be the most flamboyant part of the movie because he has to be the most normal. But I think that's a really hard thing to play. And I think he does it very well. And sorry, go ahead.
No, just funny to think of him as normal, and I think that's an accurate assessment. Like, I agree with everything you said there. It's just, you know, we start with him, like, hallucinating and jumping around his bedroom and cutting himself and, like, just Charlie Sheening around in general, I guess.
I love that scene, by the way.
Yeah, I knew you would.
I think he's incredible in that scene, and that's a part of filmmaking that I will never understand, somebody that's willing to do anything like that while on camera, and just be that emotional and, I don't know, basically falling apart.
Yeah, happy 36th birthday. yeah, no, but you're right. And then he really is kind of passive for a lot of this movie. You know, he's kind of just waiting to get to Kurtz and, you know, you see that he must disagree with so much of what Kilgore is doing and other people, even on his little four-person boat there. You know they're not acting in a way that he's generally approving of, but you just kind of have to read it in his face, and he's not very confrontational other than a few scenes in this movie. And, you know, he's very good. You know, he's seen a lot of things. You know, he's very close to death himself for a lot of times in this movie, and he plays it... so calm. And I guess that's not what Harvey Keitel was doing when they casted him, eh?
No. My understanding, I'm reading this book of conversations with Walter Murch, who's one of the editors on this movie, and the way Murch described it was he didn't see this footage until he was editing the Redux version many years later. But he said he found this old Harvey Keitel footage and was watching it. And it gave the movie a much Harvey Keitel. What he said was Harvey Keitel seemed like an assassin. You know, like he seemed like he was always going to kill Kurtz. And Martin Sheen seemed like somebody that had the potential to maybe not kill Kurtz. And that's sort of how he guessed is the reason why Keitel was replaced.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, that element certainly makes it a lot more interesting because I mean, I'm kind of like Francis Ford Coppola. I didn't know how this movie was going to end. And I kind of thinking about this movie, having not seen it and going into it. And
had you not seen Apocalypse Now either?
No, I actually hadn't.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I kind of knew, you know, it's just so pervasive in culture that I did know a lot of things about it. And I kind of just thought about it as this guy's, just like I thought we're gonna have this main character who is like a good soldier and like a normal good American boy, and the war kind of slowly drives him crazy through the progression of this movie, and then he meets up with Kurtz and I really didn't know what happened after that, but I thought Kurt's kind of, he was going to kind of go to that side and be crazier and kind of, you know, lose his mind too. Mm-hmm. He's lost his mind by the start of this movie pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah. The, I mean, the beginning of the movie is, Willard dealing with some pretty intense PTSD, even though he's still kind of in the war, you know?
Yeah. And I guess there's kind of some brief allusions to him kind of having gone home and not being able to handle it and coming back, which I don't think is the current cure for PTSD.
I'd have to check the medical files, but
yeah. And so just to, as I said, I was just expecting kind of this much more of a transition from sanity, and then the Vietnam War drives him insane, and then not really certain how the end was going to go. Mm-hmm. But it's really not like that. And we kind of have him and Kurt's, you know, I guess I don't know how to call throwing your friend's decapitated head in your lap other than not really getting along, which is another absolutely creepy part of this movie. What do you think of the ending that they actually decided on, and not only Kurt's being killed, but the way that they depict it?
I like the ending because I like the way it's cut in with sort of this ritual sacrifice, because I think one of the most interesting parts of this movie is the idea of the army deciding to kill one of their own.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the way it's cut in with this sacrifice is very interesting. It's sort of like we know he's a part of us, but this is for the greater good type of thing. And I find that really interesting.
Yeah. Sorry for the audio troubles. We're having our own hearts of darkness here, guys. But yeah, and the greater good idea kind of gets cut out by the line with extreme prejudice. But I think the idea of the United States trying to kill one of their own is just kind of interesting to me. Yeah.
Yeah, and
like there is a line where you go from being a colonel that is so highly respected to somebody they will kill, you know?
Yeah, and there's, I mean, just reading about this movie, there's tons of cool examples of, you know, character or figures in American history that this might influence this Kurt's character, as well as the books that they talk about and mm-hmm. being influenced by. And I really like the line, charging people for murder here is like handing out speeding tickets at the Indianapolis 500 or Daytona 500, whatever it is.
Yeah.
This movie does not annoy me with its narration, which sometimes can be really frustrating to me.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that this kind of does a good job of, like, you know, they always say show, don't tell, and this is a lot of telling, but it's not tons of telling. It's not so heavily narrated that it seems like a crutch, and they do so much showing in this movie, and it, like, it's so not just a straightforward story being told that when they do something that, you know, like narration that people would call a crutch, you know, there's just a million other off the wall things you could point to say, well, it's a choice, not
exactly.
Like a fallback.
Yeah. No, I enjoy the narration. I certainly don't think it hinders the film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, you are correct. There's a lot of him kind of talking about something that's happening while also talking about something that's definitely not, like, it's sort of a more abstract approach to voiceover a lot of times, you know. He's not like, so I had to go to this meeting with Harrison Ford. Yeah. He wasn't a huge star yet, guys.
I couldn't ask him to do Han Solo lines.
Martin Sheen goes in to record his voiceovers and doesn't realize he's not doing a commentary track.
you mentioned just kind of this, two things that you've brought up, I think, are late. You've mentioned that, you know, you find it interesting. You find it interesting that there's this line where, you know, you've gone so far that even your commanding officers, your superiors are going to take you out.
Yeah.
And you also talked about Willard not being like very proactive and not doing that much other than kind of a few big exceptions.
Yeah. I mean, the exceptions are large. I mean, he murders a woman, or, you know, mercy kills a woman, however you want to describe it. But
yeah, well, that was the moment I was going to ask you about. What's the motivation there? I mean, we have you said mercy killing, so we can say like, look, she's gonna die. He's putting her out of his misery. He's a nice guy. You know what? In this situation,
yeah, he's still very decisive. So I think that kind of complicates the whole thing. I think there is a bit of dominance assertion involved there, not over the woman he kills necessarily so much as Chief, just to sort of be like, I didn't want to do this. We've got to stick to the plan. And I just want everybody to know that I am in charge here. You know, this isn't my fault, but I'm ending it.
It is. And we kind of have, you know, throughout the movie, I mean, especially the kind of the middle third, we have he and Chief kind of disagreeing, but it never really coming to a head. And Willard won't describe his, you know, secret mission, but it's not really fully contradictory to what Chief's doing. So, it's not really a problem. You know, Willard just kind of sits down at the back of the boat and doesn't really talk to anybody and doesn't, you know, cause any headaches for anybody. So his secret plan is kind of fine. But, you know, they start kind of butting heads a little bit. And now, you know, he says, you know, don't stop the boat, don't do the checks. And Chief says, you know, that's what we do. That's kind of part of my job as patrol. Let's do that. And it kind of is the first moment that their goals are conflicting.
Yeah, for sure.
And then as a result, you know, we see this crazy shootout that's really surprising and horrifying. And then he really kind of puts this woman out of her misery, but at the same time kind of lets everyone know that, look, you know, I've been quiet all this time because you haven't really done anything to get in my way. But if something get in my way, you know, not I'm going to shoot you, but this is how serious I am about my goals here. And my plan is the priority here, not whatever it is you guys do when I'm not around.
Yeah, exactly. And even to touch on that a bit, like during, or how he's kind of passive, just something we haven't mentioned, even during the action sequences in this movie, even when they're being attacked on the boat and there's only four or five of them on the boat, Willard is always the last one to start firing. He's just like, there are like stretches of time that, given the situation, I think you could describe as long, where he's just doing nothing, even though there are arrows coming at them from everywhere, you know? And I find that really interesting as well, particularly since I'm pretty sure that happens after he kills this woman.
Yeah. And even before that, the scenes with Kilgore, where there are, you know, hundreds of targets to shoot at. And, you know, there's helicopters firing and, you know, people running around and it's chaos. He's relatively calm and doesn't shoot a lot of bullets.
No, exactly.
There's so much firing going on. There's so many people dying. There's so many possible targets. And he kind of just, he's there, you know, you can tell he's present, but he's just like, you could, something's missing though. Like, he's not fully there.
Yeah.
And a part of that is, I think, illustrated by his lack of firing his weapon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah. What do you think of Kilgore? He's kind of one of the most famous parts of this movie. He gets the biggest line. I think he had like 11 minutes of screen time and people like still thought he should win like Academy Awards.
It was Robert Duvall. Of course he should.
Yeah, it is Robert Duvall.
It's a national treasure.
Wearing a Civil War era hat in 1970. What did you think of him? And...
Five stars. Five stars and six Oscars.
Standard Duvall treatment.
Yeah, exactly. I think he's great. And I think his, his most famous lines are wonderful. Charlie Don't Surf is great.
That seems to be the only time like he speaks like that too.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's weird.
But it's funny. And his I love the smell of napalm in the morning speech is, of course, very famous. But I think the thing that always gets undercut by how famous that opening line of the speech is how good the ending of it is, where he says someday this and this is like the Duvall moment of the movie, where he says someday this war is going to end. And then he's like mournful about it. I think that's. That's great. And I think it's one of my favorite moments in the film. He's pretty wonderful in this movie.
You mean mournful that he would prefer these wars go on forever so he could live like this?
Exactly. It's the weird thing is that scene is that one speech is what the Hurt Locker is about, but the Hurt Locker took 2 hours to do it, whereas Bobby D took about 30 seconds and just crushed the whole thing, and it's amazing. maybe he's another irreplaceable part of this movie to me. But I think that speech is great, and I enjoy that Robert Duvall gets to play a more, swaggery type of character instead of hanging in the background. He's not really Tom Hagen like in this movie, you know?
No, he's just pure swagger, and he's really good at it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's good at everything. So
Well, and I like the just the fact that after that little speech, he kind of just stands up and walks out of frame and kind of just gives you a moment to deal with all that.
That's great. Absolutely.
Like, I think it is, you know, it does take a few seconds, but it gives you some time with that speech without really Hurt Lockering it and like ramming it down your throat. Like, it's just kind of, here it is, take a minute with this. Shit's going to happen again after this, don't worry. But
it's there, like, are still helicopters flying by in the background. This scene has to be entirely overdubbed because of all the goddamn helicopters. But
it's just kind of a nice moment of contemplation about one of the many themes in this movie. Kilgore not over the top at all for you?
Yeah, he's over the top, but I mean, so is Kurtz in a quiet way, you know?
Yeah, true.
So, I think I like Kilgore quite a bit. I think he's a really interesting part of the movie.
Did you see what John Milius, screenwriter, had to say about "I love the smell of napalm in the morning"?
No.
He said when he put that in the script, he thought to himself, this is over the top. This is the first thing they'll take out.
That's great.
Yeah, I really like that. And I guess Kilgore's name was originally supposed to be Colonel Carnage, which is just fully a superhero villain.
Yeah, exactly.
Kilgore is still pretty on the nose, but not, not too direct.
Carnage, yeah. Well, they were going to spell Carnage with a K.
And Colonel with a K.
Yeah, it's just a Donkey Kong character.
In 1976. Yeah. Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. You're welcome, Francis Ford Coppola, for the sequel. Apocalypse Again.
What else do you have to say about this movie?
I mean, you never actually said if you liked it.
It's... I guess I do. It was... I don't know. It's just a hard movie to watch. And, you know, I don't know. It's not emotionally. I don't know.
You sound like you're in the middle of an emotional struggle, though.
No, I don't know what it just really threw me for a loop. Like, I knew, obviously, a Vietnam War movie is not going to be a feel-good movie.
Yeah.
But it was just really unsettling. And I know I've used that word, like, 20 times already. You know, and maybe I'm thinking too much about Hearts of Darkness as well, and kind of the whole process of it, and kind of what a nightmare it was putting it all together. The product on screen is like, I can't think of the closest movie I've seen to Apocalypse Now, which usually is at least a testament to its originality and its willingness to be different. I just don't know if I would ever watch this movie again. Okay. Even though there are some parts of it that, you know, visually I think are so good. I think Robert Duvall is really, really entertaining in this. I think that the kind of that acid trip bridge scene is really well put together and really has an emotional impact. It's just not one I ever want to experience.
I understand that. That's kind of something that I think is good about the movie. I think it further helps the movie's points. There's a line in the movie, every man has a breaking point. I think that's very much what this movie is about. And I think that's kind of what you've described in the experience of watching it. I agree with you. I think it's incredibly unsettling, but it's weird. There are, this movie, like, it's the type of unsettling that gets me very excited. So I'm like smiling very broadly while watching this movie, but also simultaneously being kind of terrified. But it also, it fits into this category of film that I think is always so interesting in that it's a really good director's carte blanche movie where they're coming off of something that's so impossible to talk shit about, that made money, and they can do what they want. And I think that's always where you find the most, like, the real heart of this person, this director, in that movie. I know I've talked about this on the podcast before, but Paul Thomas Anderson had that with The Master. Christopher Nolan had it with Inception. Francis Ford Coppola has it with this. He had it a bit with After the Godfather, but he still had it for The Godfather 2. For The Conversation.
This is just so much bigger than The Conversation.
Exactly. And then The Conversation wasn't a big hit, and then the combination of The Godfather 1 and Godfather 2, which admittedly The Godfather 2, I think, grossed only half of what The Godfather grossed, but that's still pretty damn good. And that sort of bought him all of this capital to make Apocalypse Now, even though he did have to put up a lot of the money himself. And I think that's sort of where you get this director who is clearly a smart person, clearly very good at their job, and is finally, probably for the only time in their career, at the point where they can do exactly what they want to do. And there's that added pressure of knowing that you're in the one portion of your career where you can do exactly what you want to do. And this is the movie that came out of it. And I find that really fascinating. And I always find that fascinating with a director, even if the movie doesn't end up being that good, like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was Fincher's. I find that such an interesting place for a good director to be. And this is one of those movies, of which there are like maybe 20, you know? It's just such a specific number of things that have to come into play.
Yeah, no, and you kind of can't even set out to make that movie like consciously. It kind of has to be at that point in your career, and then you just, you know, you go for it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a little, very small, tiny subgenre that like needs history and economics to all line up. And
exactly. It's like what I was saying with The Devil's Own, not to go back to an already overlong point, but it's just sort of like, oh, things have lined up perfectly. This is the only time I can do this. I need to act now. And then you do it, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, he's got his quote in Heart of Darkness, Hearts of Darkness, right at the beginning. This isn't about Vietnam. This is Vietnam.
Yeah, that was.
Oh, that really had me worried. Like, I knew I was going to like that documentary because, like, nightmare filmmaking is a topic I really enjoy hearing about. But I was worried if we were just going to get so much douchey Coppola. And you don't. Like, you don't get tons of it at all.
Yeah, and the setting of that press conference was very intense in general. And I think that was the first time he was showing it. He wasn't showing what ended up being the completed version. He had taken such a beating in the press over the past number of years. And I think that was him. That was his moment of shooting the woman in the head, basically. Like, he had to put his foot down about the way he was being talked about. And I think there are a lot of moments in Francis Ford Coppola's career where he kind of oversteps his bounds in that type of way, but I think it's the documentary positions, it makes it him seem much crazier in that opening than he actually is, I think. Just because they don't give you the context yet.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, him saying this is Vietnam, I think, is kind of the point we're making right before this, where you know, you're not supposed to enjoy it. And you know, we have a lead character in Willard who is, as we discussed, really not that proactive, and really doesn't say a lot. Like, he's very reticent for this movie, and he always takes a few seconds to talk, even when he does talk. Mm-hmm. And he's just kind of thoughtful and clearly dealing with so much stuff. And I think it's just kind of the American psyche being so scarred by this war, and you know, this movie, you know, showing so much of the dark stuff. And, you know, as he says in Hearts of Darkness, and you know, anytime he talks about, Coppola seems to talk about this movie, as much as it is about the Vietnam War, it's also just about humanity in general, and the Vietnam War just being a big recent example of how things can just go so poorly. And this movie just kind of revels in the worst part.
Yeah.
Can get, and that's why, for as gorgeous and as impressive as it is in so many ways, it's just not enjoyable to me.
Yeah. Well, and there are a lot of, to go back to the, you know, the political aspects of this movie, I suppose, there's not a lot where they really focus on that stuff other than showing you, I suppose, the horrors. You know, like Lance is named, his initials are LBJ. You would think that, and he's just a pretty passive observer. You'd think that's some sort of mild criticism of Lyndon Johnson. But it doesn't totally line up, and they don't go too hard on it. And even the scene at the very beginning where he's actually meeting, Willard's meeting with some of his higher ups, there's not too much actually talked about that's really over the top. And, we're saying something about this current government type of thing.
Yeah. And if it's.
Sorry, you cut out?
No, just for Vietnam movies, it's always supposed to be, you know, as you said, like, let's, you know, criticize the current administration. Let's criticize the people who got us in this mess. And in that meeting with, you know, the one that you were just describing with those two, I guess, commanders or whatever they are near the beginning, that seems like the people who would totally be targets of criticism, and they seem like kind of nice, normal people. Like, their criticism of Kurtz is not that, you know, he's leaking American secrets to the press. It's he's leading this little army of his and like beheading people and having psychological warfare on innocent people.
Yeah.
You know, that just seemed like, you know, when I saw he was going to go in and meet the, you know, the bigger higher ups, I thought we would get that kind of very vague, obvious criticism of like the American government, and you don't get that. They kind of just describe someone who seems to have gone crazy and is now doing crazy things, and let's stop him. And, you know, you can argue the kind of the morality of killing another U.S. citizen or something like this, but he seems to have really denounced everything and gone completely batshit. So, like, you don't really feel bad for him, and you don't feel like, you know, you hate the White House now, having dealt with these guys. You know what I mean, though?
Yeah, absolutely, I do. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's just, it's very much it seems very much like a criticism of the Vietnam War, but it just doesn't come with a lot of the things that you expect with that criticism.
Yeah. And we never get a step outside of the Vietnam War in this movie. You know, there's no board on the 4th of July moment of Tom Cruise addressing the nation or whatever, you know?
Yeah, we just deal with it as kind of soldiers, but it's, again, as much as it is so much about Vietnam, they don't take obvious moments to make the typical Vietnam criticisms and really spend more time dealing with this on a much kind of broader, deeper, timeless human theme.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you asked me a couple days ago via text message what my favorite war movie is. And I'm curious to know what yours is.
No, I don't know mine either.
Oh, okay. Because my answer is this or The Thin Red Line. And it's just because you know, I'm not huge on war movies in general, and so I gravitate towards the more bizarre ones, the ones that don't really fit the war movie. Formula is a bit strong of a word, but, you know, the
genre?
Yeah, exactly. And
Glorious Bastards?
But that's, Quentin Tarantino's his own. And I like the Thin Red Line in Apocalypse Now as wholes better than I like Inglourious Basterds as a whole, even though Inglourious Basterds has sections that I think are pretty great. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you said Tarantino's his own thing. Who directed Thin Red Line?
Terrence Malick.
Isn't he kind of his own thing?
Thin Red Line is still where he's kind of sticking to some form of narrative. Okay. And yeah, the Thin Red Line and Tree of Life are vastly different films.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a pre Tree of Life Malick, you know, and he occasionally dealt with plot.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man. We'll be back next week talking about something. Check out our website, themcguffinman.com, and follow us on Twitter, @themcguffinman.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themcguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.